Googled, found nutritionists, found James Collier as now our co-founder. 2 weeks later, he gave me the formula for Huel, which is pretty much identical to what we got today. Every supermarket's got food which is optimised for taste, and we're optimised for nutrition. The primary purpose of food is nutrition. It isn't taste. You can live without taste, you can live without any texture, but you can't live without nutrition. So it's quite bizarre how everything in the food industry is all focused around taste.
I bet you 50 quid you'll love Pleo. All right, I'm bending the truth slightly, but they're so sure you'll join me as a customer that they've put the money on it. Their smarter spending platform for business expenses is so good that as soon as you've had a demo, they'll give you £50 on their card just to discover how much of a game changer it is. That's right, your next team lunch on Pleo. If you are a leader, secret or not, all you need to do is visit www.pleo.io/leaders and book a demo today.
And now, before we get started with today's episode, I want to let you know that I'm here in the studio with Jamie Lang, the host of well-established Private Parts podcast, as well as a recently launched entrepreneurial show called Move.
Hello, listeners.
Now, Jamie and his business partner, Ed Williams, chat to people like fashion designer Henry Holland, founder of Suitcase magazine Serena Gwen, and Michelle Kennedy, the founder of Peanut, the networking app for new mums. Jamie, in one sentence, why should people of Secret Leaders listen to Move?
Okay, probably because we go in depth with entrepreneurs, artists, innovative thinkers, and visionaries to bring you two inspirational episodes per interviewee.
Right, so once you've made your way through all 48 episodes of Secret Leaders, you know, maybe even earlier than that, head over to your podcast listening platform of choice and download Move. I highly recommend it. Today's guest is Julian Hearn, the founder of the powdered food product Huel. Huel is marketed as a super convenient, nutritionally complete meal replacement, and with sales of £14 million last year and a projection for 2019 at more than £40 million, makes Huel one of Britain's fastest growing businesses, full stop. Are those numbers still true, Julian?
Well, we did 40. That closed at the in Jan.
There we go. Already smashing through those targets. This is how current growth looks like. Before Huel, Julian worked in marketing, working with brands including Waitrose and House of Fraser, but tired of the commute, he set up a voucher business from home, famously telling his wife that if he couldn't match his salary in 6 months, he'd go back and get a real job. And that business eventually sold for more than $10 million. What does she think about that real job?
What did she think about my real job?
Yeah, the real job that you left and did. Was she all right with this decision?
I think she, looking back, she's very happy with that decision, yeah.
Okay. He said at the time, I had enough money to retire, but you get bored and I needed something to stay busy. So his answer to staying busy was getting back into business. And after a few failed ventures, he eventually founded Huel. It hasn't been all plain sailing, though, with a number of road bumps along the way, which I'm sure we're going to find out about today, I hope. So without further ado, welcome, Julian.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, before we start and get into the real nitty-gritty, we've got a little quick-fire round. So, office or gym?
Gym.
City or countryside?
Countryside?
You're not sure?
Well, the countryside can be a little bit dull all the time, so we do live out in the countryside, but yeah, I think I prefer that. City's too busy.
Yeah, okay. Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Trapped on a desert island, you can bring three things. Your wife's already there.
Phone, charger, solar panelled, obviously. Music device of some description.
Are you one of the only people in the world with a phone without a music device?
Well, it's not very good sound quality, is it? You want something a little wonderboom
like
or something?
A Sonos, a solar-powered Sonos.
Yeah, indeed.
Got you. Who's the most inspirational person to you?
Oh, my God. Inspirational. We went to Fast Track the other day. Richard Branson came on Skype. He's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Was he on Necker Island? Was he Skyping him from Necker?
I don't know, because then he stopped halfway through. He said, "Oh, sorry about that. There's a football match going on in the background." So I thought, well, I'm not sure Necker Island's got a football pitch, but possibly.
It's got tennis courts. It's got quite a few, hasn't it? Because he hosts that tennis tournament.
Yeah, possibly.
But probably not big football matches, I don't think. Yeah. Well, the next question was entrepreneur you look up to. It sounds like he's the man. So what's a different one?
It's strange, because I don't think I look up to anybody in particular. I think he's sort of, there's lots and lots of people that do incredibly well, but top of my head, I don't know. Steve Jobs is obviously incredible what he achieved and the way he did it as well.
Let's get cracking with the actual interview part. We can understand a little bit about what motivates you. You've mentioned marketing and brand as like the core of what excites you. So take us back before Huel. So as I understand it, you were commuting from Aylesbury.
Correct.
Which, for all of you don't know, is just outside of London, an hour outside of London. And did like your whole entrepreneurial journey start just because you didn't want to do that commute?
Yeah, basically. Me and my wife were trying to have a baby and we'd had a few problems, a few miscarriages. So I wanted to be at home with her. So I just realised that doing 3 hours a day commute plus a full day's work was not that attractive. Aylesbury is not exactly a hotbed of startups or cool companies to work at. So there was no alternative.
It is now, you're there.
It is now. But at the time, there was no alternative in terms of a good job and good salary in the local area. So I thought, well, I need a way to work from home. And luckily, I went to an affiliate meetup. And there were some guys there who were earning serious money working from home in their pajamas. And I just thought, if they can do it, why can't I do it?
And what was the answer?
I spent the next year learning the ropes in the evenings and weekends, so I didn't just jack my job in and just jump straight into it. I took a while to get confident because I had a mortgage to pay and bills to pay, so I thought, well, I need to work this out first before I just jump ship. And so spent, evenings and weekends, coming from work at 7 o'clock at night, have my dinner, then get on the computer, read, learn, practice till 10, 11 o'clock at night, go to bed, get up and do it again.
Internet marketing for dummies?
Exactly right. So literally just, luckily I knew some of it, but the affiliate marketing was a new world for me really. So I just sort of immersed myself in that, practiced and made a little bit of money on the way in that year. And then got to a stage where I thought, right, I know what I'm doing. I'm making some money, but I need to put more time into it. And that's when I said to my wife, right, I need to just go full time this, jack my job, and off I went.
What year was this?
It would have been 2007, I think.
Okay, so 2007, you've set up promotionalcodes.co.uk?
Correct.
Tell us about that. What was the, as a brand and marketing guy, what was your original pitch? How did you think about this? Was it literally just, a traffic game, or did you try and put like a brand behind it? What was your vision for it?
There was no brand at all, really. It was literally just like, I need to make some money. What's the best way to make some money? And in the affiliate world, the biggest area at the time was voucher codes. So I thought, well, I'll go after that, and spent a long time looking at the other sites of how they were doing it, and realized they'd missed an area, which was that there's three words that are used on checkouts. It's either
Pizza,
voucher
express, free.
It's either voucher codes, discount codes, which was well covered by the other sites, but nobody had gone after promotional codes, which actually appeared on quite a lot of the checkouts. So people search for the word they see on the checkout, and lots of people hadn't gone after that word. So that's why I registered that very sexy domain name and went after those and just started very small, just going one page at a time, whereas most people chucked up a site with like every merchant, or stick every merchant on it, just hope someone would land. I just started with, say, five merchants and just sent links to those five pages. So a page against another page from a bigger site can win just by links to that one site. But if you've got 2,000 pages, you've got to send a lot of links to it.
Did you learn to code yourself, or did
No code.
Do you outsource that? Or?
Correct, yeah. I found a guy that, interestingly enough, I worked with him solid for 3 years, and I never spoke to him on the phone. I never Skyped him, never met him in person. It was all done via email and Basecamp. He was a guy based out in Serbia.
Oh, wow.
And no problems?
No problems. His English was better than me. He's written English.
Okay, but you both understood point and click here.
Exactly.
Yeah, understood. Okay, so what was the journey wrapping up for promotional codes? You ended up selling it.
Correct.
How did that happen?
About 2 years into the site, I realized that it was an SEO play. SEO is great because it's free if you can get it to work, but it can be short-lived. You never really know what Google are going to do. So if you base all your business on SEO, it's quite scary. So I started thinking, right, this is worth some money at the moment. If I can sell it now, I've got enough money to retire. And so I actually got onto Google, Googled how to sell a company, and looked around, found this guy who's actually now one of our non-execs. And he helped me package the business up to sell it. It took about a year in total to get everything together. He sorted all the legal side out, sorted the accounts out for me, stuff like that. And then he packaged it up, put it out, and we eventually found an American company who wanted to buy it and sold it onto them.
Mm. I think a lot of founders find that challenging when they come to a point where they know they want to get out of their business, or then they stop selling their own product and they think, how am I going to actually sell my business? And obviously that's why bankers exist, I guess. But it's also psychologically quite difficult, because all the way along your business, you've been showing the passion about your business, to then go, I actually want out and I want to sell it.
Yeah, the lucky thing was I wasn't that passionate about it. I was passionate about making money. That was my objective, was to make money. So it wasn't like a real, it's not different to Huel. Huel is something I really believe in. Yeah. Whereas this that site was literally something to make money to solve a problem. So I wanted to work from home, and that was the goal. It wasn't to build a great brand or anything like that. It's literally, I need to solve this problem. How do I do it? So when I wanted to sell it, I was quite happy to sell for the right price.
So, you know, take experience into someone who's had a career in, you know, your everyday jobs like most of us. And then you've decided to go and do something because you couldn't be bothered to do the commute, and you've successfully exited for, was it around $10 million? So at that point, is there no sort of, right, I'm going to retire, I'm going to sit on a yacht? Because I can't buy a yacht with $10 million, but you can sit on one.
Yeah.
If you wanted to.
I'm sure you can buy some yachts for $10
million. Yeah, possibly. But you can definitely sit on a yacht for that much. So, you know, there was no idea of just, you know, doing this, relaxing.
Well, we had a child by that stage, so we all spent a lot of time at home. If you've got young children, you probably know exactly what it's like. They're very time-consuming, you know, in a positive way. So, you know, you literally, you know, you put everything into those. So me and my wife were at home, you know, I had a young boy, and, you know, it was very nice. But we did talk about going away. We went on holidays and things like that. We did spend a little bit of money. We bought a house down on the coast, spent a lot of time down there. So we had, you know, a good lifestyle. But, you know, being at home with a young child all day long can get a little bit, you know, once you've watched children's TV for a few days, let alone a few months, can get a little bit not satisfying.
Yep.
So I wanted something else to do, so I wanted something 3 days a week. I wanted to get that work, proper work-life balance. I didn't need to work, but I wanted to do something that was fulfilling and kept me a little bit busy. My dad at the time was about 75 years old, and he was still working 3 days a week. And the way he put it to me, he goes, well, if I'm not working, what am I going to do? You know, like he, and I think I've got the same sort of mentality that, you know, working full hardcore 7 days a week is not the right thing to do, but just not working at all didn't feel like the right thing to do. You want to get that balance.
Give us an idea here. So the period of time between selling and starting up the next thing, which as I understand it wasn't actually successful.
Yep.
What was that time period? And also, is it unusual for you, like a second question, so sorry, they're all coming out thick and fast now. Was it unusual for you to have gone from success and I guess the confidence that comes with that, that you know what you're doing, to then starting something, I guess anything new you start, you don't really feel like you understand it. You know, you're going in cold and learning new things, but you hadn't experienced failure yet.
Yeah, I mean, the second business I started was something called Body Hack, and it was a fitness comparison site, effectively. I had a genius idea that there's a lot of internet information out there, what to eat, what to do, exercise, but nobody really knows which one's better than the other. So the idea was we'd put them all into one big site, and they could be directly compared. And the way you do that is you put people through different fitness programs, different meal plans, and then you would take all their measurements, you take all the photographs, you could see which ones worked, and the best ones would float to the top, and you'd buy that program. That was the idea of it. So spent, I don't know, 6 months on that. And we launched, got some initial traction. We appeared on the homepage of Hacker News, got loads of traffic. Some people have signed up to programs straight away, thought this is going to fly. And it was one of those classic ones, you get the initial PR burst, and then it sort of dies away. And I started thinking, this is going to be hard graft, because I was one of the guinea pigs for the first program. We've got five people to put through, but it's really like time consuming to do. And you've got to persuade people to follow something rigid for 3 months. You know, no going out, no drinking, you know, trying to get it. So it was
repeat. This is like Rich's ideal lifestyle, basically, you're describing, though. This is the polyphasic sleeping, no eating, and just, you know, don't be social.
Why do you think I got Julian along?
Yeah, exactly.
So we're trying to get the, you know, repeatable results. And so to do that, you have to be very precise. So it's hard graph. The initial traction, I think that if I probably stuck with it, I probably could have made it work. So you could say it was a failure. But what happened was when I started speaking to people, they said, right, I want those results, but I'm not going to do what you did. It was just too much hard work. You know, I was cooking from scratch and weighing every bit of food that I ate. And it was three main meals and three snacks per day. And the, you know, guys who are at work goes, I can't stop at 11 o'clock and cook an egg and 100 grams of broccoli. I can't stop at lunchtime and cook 200 grams of turkey and 200 grams of baby spinach, some quinoa. And they just said, it's not practical. You know, that is somebody who doesn't work. And at the time I wasn't working, so it's fine for me. So it made me think, right, okay, this could work, but even if we put all the effort in, I'm still only going to sell a small amount of programs and people are not going to be able to repeat the results because it's too difficult. So it made me think there must be a better way to do this. Protein shakes was what we was using in the afternoon, and super convenient, super easy to do, but you can't live off protein alone. So I thought, well, why can't we just put all the nutrients into a single product? It makes life a lot easier, and then people could repeat the results. And so that's when I Googled, found nutritionists, found James Collier, who is now a co-founder, And 2 weeks later, he gave me the formula for Huel, which is pretty much identical to what we got today.
But you have iterated on it quite a bit, because I think the version I lost was like V2.3 or something like that.
Correct.
So what have you changed? Because I think a lot of the early feedback was about taste, was it? Or
yes, I mean we have changed it. So some of it, most of this is tweaks rather than massive changes. So the original formula James gave me was 6 core ingredients plus a vit blend. Those 6 core ingredients, which are oats, flaxseed, pea, rice, coconut and sunflower, they're all the same 6 as it was originally. So the vit blend is pretty similar as well, but it's all been tweaks and changes. It's like it's not micro adjustments, slightly bigger than that, but there's been changes. Taste has changed. We've brought out pre-blends. It's pretty similar though. You know, if you look back, it's not wildly, wildly different. So that was the core learning really, is that something that's simple and convenient, and that's what I think has exploded, is that people want healthy, convenient food, whereas nearly every convenience food you currently eat is pretty low quality or junk food. It's got stuff in there that shouldn't really be in there, or it's just got the wrong macro and micronutrients. It just doesn't give you what you need. And the sort of key thing that we've spot really is that every supermarket has got food which is optimized for taste, and we're optimized for nutrition. The primary purpose of food is nutrition. It isn't taste. You can live without taste. You can live without any texture, but you can't live without nutrition. So it's quite bizarre how everything in the food industry is all focused around taste.
This podcast is brought to you by Klaviyo, the growth marketing platform most recommended by other business leaders. And last year, 67 new brands switched to Klaviyo every single day. From a shopper's first impression to each subsequent purchase, Klaviyo understands every interaction, empowering brands to create more personalized marketing moments. When you have a 360-degree view of your customer, the growth possibilities are endless. Klaviyo truly understands how challenging it is for each and every entrepreneur to get their business off the ground. The cost of acquiring new customers is continuing to rise. Brands are experiencing diminishing returns as well as a small audience reach. Their marketing efforts are continually being squeezed. But Klaviyo is helping brands take back control by leveraging their own marketing channels like email, web, and mobile to provide exceptional customer experiences. Klaviyo continues to help hundreds of thousands of business leaders just like me grow globally. Visit klaviyo.com/leaders, that's klaviyo.com/leaders today to find out more. Now back to the show.
And just getting an insight into the company now.
Yeah.
So take us through the first year.
We launched in 2015. I'd probably been working on it for about a year to 18 months. And the sort of key difference for us was that powders have been used in, say, the bodybuilding world for decades. We've been giving powdered food to our babies for decades as well. But for just the normal sort of Joe public, it was not used. You know, it's a novel type of thing. And that was one of our key things. We didn't want to target the bodybuilding industry. They were well satisfied with what the products they already had. And so we wanted to appeal to normal people who worked in an office, really, who didn't have that convenience, healthy food. You know, they had sandwiches or they had crisps and chocolate or they had toast or cereal. None of those things are particularly great for you. So it's trying to give them something different. That's why our packaging is quite different from what you'd see in the normal bodybuilding world, where they do a lot of call outs on their packaging and make sort of quite strong claims. We try to minimalize it right down, clean it right down, make it simple and more universally acceptable.
Yeah, if you haven't seen Huel's packaging, for anyone listening, it's the most clean cut, apple-like kind of food packaging ever. Obviously, that's been a really core focus of yours, is the brand, and you've built a really strong brand from that. Going from your last business where you just said that brand didn't really matter to this one, was that something that was quite daunting? And how did you kind of launch the brand? Was that done in-house? Was that external? Coming up with all that?
The starting point really was I wanted to do something that I liked personally. So it was something that this was supposed to be a lifestyle business. This was not supposed to grow into what it's grown into. Yeah, the idea was keep me busy for 3 days a week. So basically I made a product for me. So when I started using, you know, when I made the product, I thought, I'm not that unusual, I don't think. So if I just should be able to find 1,000 people who are similar to me in the country and they pay £45 a month, that's £45,000 a month, that's £500,000 a year business, something to keep me interested. It's something that I'm going to do. I'm not going to sort of compromise on anything. I'm going to make it exactly as I would. So I would wear the clothing. I would use the product. I want it to look the way I would wanted, so it was made for me, really. That's what I wanted to do. So in terms of the actual logo, I came up with a name, and then I think I went
on... stand for Human Fuel?
Correct.
It's
yeah.
A good guess.
Yeah. Human Fuel. And
did you know?
Yeah, I knew that. But
you look really smug.
I'm actually quite pleased with that. You must be quite pleased. A brand works really well when he can kind of guess what it stands for based on the on it. And it's not.
I mean, I know it's pretty obvious, but yeah, still. It took away my pride, that's for sure.
It takes a very long time to come up with the right name. And so I went through quite a few. And
What was the worst name? Give us some of the clangers.
Hoylent.
There was a lot. And then I went on Dribbble, I think, to find a designer. And I thought, I don't want to go to a London branding agency, going to cost an absolute fortune. I'd already burnt some money on Bodyhack. So I wanted to do it. You know, I wanted someone who could design. I wanted to look really good. So I found this freelance designer on Dribbble, who was based in Turkey, I think. And he did the initial designs, already clean designs, all really nice, gave him a very simple thing. I just wanted to be authentic, wanted to look, you know, clean, simple, minimal. And when he came back with it, you know, there was a few iterations, but basically he got it right first time.
Yep.
And he did the original packaging for us as well. And then we did a revision. We went to the current packaging. So we did the same revision for that. And that's basically the design. So we haven't changed it. You know, I wanted it to stick. You know, I think it's wrong to keep changing and chopping and changing your logos. So basically it's the same one we've used since day one.
And then obviously you were saying you worked on this pre-launch for about 18 months. Was that just refining the product? No?
No. It was basically trying to get the bloody thing made. It was absolutely ridiculously difficult. We already had the formula. Pretty much. 3 months later, you know, I'd spoken to a lot of people, but had no real manufacturer lined up, and then kept going. People let you down. People don't get back to you. They don't really want to do it. There's sort of lack of commitment. Eventually, we found this big multinational to make it. 4 months later, you know, I was all happy. I thought we was done. So this is nearly a year into it. He sent me an email, said, "No, I'm not going to do it." I nearly gave up at that stage because it'd be so difficult. I thought, well, I've been at this a bloody year. I can't even make a powder that you can make in your kitchen in 5 minutes. You know, if you get these powders together, you can put them in there. The VIP blend is quite complicated, but to get that done, just put it all in and blend it. It doesn't seem like it's massively complicated. It's not like making, you know, an iPhone or something that is complicated. It's just pretty basic stuff. But the food industry, you know, even, you know, we're now 4 years after we've launched, we still have trouble with the food industry. They are slow. Don't really want to do new things. One of the guys, we must have spoke to about 100 plus manufacturers, spoke to one guy eventually, said, look, the reason why people don't want to, or not helping you, is because they don't really want to make new stuff, because typically they get called all of the time by new startups who want to start it. They've got bright ideas. Typically they go nowhere. So they have to change their line. They have to make this new product. They take a very small order. They put a load of time and effort into it. And then quite often there's no reorder. So they don't really want to do it. And that's been the problem ever since. They're just, you know, they're factories. They want to make stuff exactly the same every single time. Just keep going, reproducing the same stuff. To make something new, they have to order new ingredients. They might have to do new tests. They might have to change their line. They just don't want to do it. That's what slowed the whole thing down, is literally just getting the thing made.
Looking forward, or actually, before we look forward, like just day to day, like what is your interaction with the company currently? You've got a new CEO in, well, not new anymore, I suppose. Yep. So what was the process of picking the CEO? You mentioned at the start, you know, the things you don't like doing. You know, we heard even last night from David Buttress of Just Eat, you know, discussing the hardest thing as a CEO is sort of realizing your own limitations and being humble enough to accept it at the right time for the best of the company. Did you go through like a almost tormented phase with yourself, or was it just so obvious to you when you wanted to hire a CEO in?
It was pretty obvious, yeah. I was struggling. My background is brand and marketing, so I think the key problem arose when I just realised I wasn't doing any of that anymore. So the stuff that I'm good at, I'm not actually getting to do because I'm too busy doing other stuff that I'm not good at. So it just didn't make any sense. So I was really struggling. I was just spread yourself incredibly thin. And you just feel like you're not doing a good job at anything. And the stuff that I was good at, I couldn't hardly get to. I just had to leave for months and months, you know. And so I struggled. Yeah, it's very clear that I needed some additional help. And so I went on LinkedIn. I don't use recruiters. I don't like them. I think they're very expensive. So we do all our recruitment in-house. And so I went on LinkedIn, searched for or looked around for some companies that I sort of thought were pretty good. I just wanted to see somebody with a bit of food experience because we didn't have anybody in-house really that worked in the food industry. and found James, who's now our CEO. And I did reach out, or actually use somebody else to reach out and set up some interviews. And he came in and, yeah, really good guy.
Okay. It's 2019. Can you give me an idea of, 2015, high level numbers, 16, 17, people, obviously revenue if you're comfortable doing it, or units sold. Like, it's really helpful for us to get an idea of that explosive journey. Because, again, it's not like you've created a product that's, a slightly different brand to what else was already on there. It's an explosive market disruptor in a real sense, as in it's a product that didn't really exist. Like we say, Soylent was in the US, very different kind of product.
Yep.
This is creating a whole new category.
Yeah, we see it as a new category. We want to call that complete food. So our first year, we launched in June 2015. So the first 6 months, which is year end is January. So we did £750,000 in the first 6 months. The second year.
In your first year?
Yeah.
Oh, so you beat your own targets.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then we went to, the first full year, but the second year we did 5.7. Then it was 14.1. Then it was 40. And this year, so Jan 2019 to Jan 2020, we're going to do 60 to 70.
Interesting. How do you view, and I guess forgive the nosy question, but it's my job. How do you view the difference between the massive shift from, let's say, 15 to 40 and then 40 to 60? Is that really difficult and pressured? Because, obviously there's two sides to this. One is you've got to grow the market, which can only happen at a certain rate. And there's also potentially at the point where Huel's concept is so new and exciting. That is where I imagine that huge growth came from in, I guess, year three. That's probably the point at which maybe I was at year two or three. I think we were both drinking at the same time.
He likes to think he's a trendsetter.
I think maybe Rich was having it first because too lazy to cook. But the point being, that is a point of huge mass awareness. And then the market starts to get a little bit saturated and difficult. How do you find that sort of challenge of going from 40 to 60? And do you have, in your projections, are you thinking about, the market's obviously slowing because there's just less customers that necessarily fit into that category? Or
I don't really know the answer. I think the numbers get bigger and bigger. We're doing in a month now, we're doing more than what we did in a whole year. So to keep beating your own numbers does get difficult. It is easy in the early days, I suppose. You've got the early adopters just come in, people trying the product, and it is a novel product compared to what the mass majority would use. So it's more early adopters and more innovators that are going to use this type of product. So
your ambassadors are called Huligans.
Huligans. And so we've got a very strong community, but it's a vegan product, which sometimes doesn't appeal to everybody. So there is a certain niche of people that are interested in this type of thing.
Julian, I want to talk about something slightly different. What is the cost of a Huel meal, in theory?
I think the cheapest way to get it is about £1.31.
Without making you sound like you might solve world hunger, is there an angle here of, the cost of a meal per day, globally in areas where there is extreme poverty, and you've created a product that is a food replacement and it's a full total nutrition at the moment? It's people like Rich and I that, are typically having it. You're busy. You don't want to go without food. It's good to have, a great level there.
Yep.
But we're spending £1.22 to make sure we're not skipping lunch or whatever. But ultimately, obviously, there's people around the world that can't afford to have meals per day or whatever. Is there an angle of philanthropy that you think you could go into with this?
Possibly.
Something you've discussed or considered?
Yeah, we've been asked about it many times. I think the way we're currently set up doesn't work for that type of thing because we're shipping quite a heavy product. We're making it in one of the most expensive parts of the world. Then shipping a heavy product to possibly one of the poorest parts in the world doesn't currently make sense. We've had people contact us before. We said we're happy to tell you our formula. The formula's on the back of the pack. We can help you do it. If you want to make it locally in a poorer part of the world, that'd be the way to do it rather than ship it from the UK and make it in the UK. You need to buy the ingredients locally and make it that way.
Interesting. It is interesting that other people have also pointed this out, right? Because the cost of the product and the cost of what people actually make in other parts of the world as well. So it's fascinating. Potentially your next business when you get bored sitting on all the yachts that you've already bought, right?
One thing we haven't quite fully touched on is actually you've grown incredibly, but has it been all funded from your initial capital that you put in from your exit?
Yeah, so I put some money into BodyHack, which is a company before Huel, And then I put a little bit into Huel. So when I say, sorry, a little bit, it wasn't really a little bit, probably a couple hundred thousand pounds in total. Okay. So in Bodyhack, I burnt probably about 80, 90, I think. And then so therefore just over 100 into Huel in total. Put that in from day one, never topped up. So we just used off that. We were profitable for the first 3 years.
That is incredible.
Oh, so you're 100% owned by you and your business partner?
No, because we took investment last year.
Okay.
So October last year, we took investment, put £20 million from Highland Europe, valued us at £220 million.
Amazing.
And
congrats.
Thank you. The reason we took that money is because I suppose we didn't need it technically, but
best time to take money when you don't need it.
Correct.
They say.
Yeah, you can do a much better deal if you do that. You don't want to raise when you need money because you're over a barrel, really. So you don't want to do that. So we made sure that we raised when we didn't actually need the money, and we've taken it because you just can't see the future. So it's a massive insurance policy. So if there's any problems, we can buy our way out of them. There's any opportunities, we can buy our way into them. So it's money in the bank.
These series and our live events wouldn't be possible without the awesome continued support of LaFosse Associates, the brilliant recruitment partner of choice for us and most our guests. After all, you can't build a great company without great people, and that's why great people trust LaFosse. Check out www.lafosse.com today.
When you pitch someone and you're taking in a $220 million valuation, obviously they're expecting an exit. That's all part of the story.
Yep.
What is the story of exit that you told?
I'm not sure. We did pitch, to be honest. I'm not sure that it was quite that. We did it that way. We did do a deck. But in terms of pitch, it was much more of a general conversation. We didn't have to stand up and do formal presentations. The exit, I'm not sure what we said about that, really. I think we just said, look, we can see how a path to get to £1 billion valuation, pounds. And it was pretty straightforward in that respect. I think they just saw the growth. The good thing is with Highland Europe, we were first into their new fund. So arguably got a 10-year horizon on that. They're under no time pressure at all. We're therefore under no time pressure. But, you know, we know they put some money in, so they're going to want to get some money out at some stage. We've also given share options to everybody in the business. Quite generous ones. So those guys, you know, we've recruited sometimes on that share option, you know, sort of said, look, come and join us. You're going to get a chunky number at the end. So there needs to be an end point, you know, some sort of exit, whether that's an IPO, whether it's a trade sale. We haven't decided yet, but we see that happening, you know, in roughly 4 years' time.
Julian, take us through a typical day-to-day for you nowadays. What is it like? Are you doing your three-day weeks like you always planned?
No, I'm not doing 3 days a week.
All the time, is what I see, yeah.
I'm down to about 4 days a week now. So it's getting there, not quite there, 3 days. So I'm CMO. So that's my background in marketing. So I spend all my time on brand and marketing. But the way I see marketing, where a lot of people use the word marketing and advertising interchangeably, advertising is one part of marketing. The way I see it is anything that connects with the customer, I should stick my nose into and see how it's going. So the beauty of that means is even though I'm not CEO, I can still argue that if, say, our operations are not working smoothly enough, say the delivery is late, I can say, well, that's affecting the customer. I want that fixed. If the product's late and the manufacturer's not right, then I can say, well, that's affecting the customer. Get it fixed. So I'm still involved. You know, we've got a board meeting on Friday. We go into that. And I'm still heavily involved in everything, keep an eye on everything. But it just means that I can sort of give my opinion without actually having to go down to the minutest detail and follow it all the way through. I can still say this needs to be done in a different way. And then we've got a team now to make it happen.
And also it makes sense, right? You are the brand champion. You're the person with a vision that wanted it to happen because you would have it and you feel like other people would have it. And that prediction's come true. So in many ways, I often think this, like, it is a perfectly logical thing for the founder to take a role of chief brand ambassador, call it CMO, some people call it creative officer. There's all those different things.
Yeah.
But like realistically, it is quite rare that that person's best place in the company is the CEO because they have the massive passion of the building part.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it starts to get big and process driven, you know, it's not really the same kind of lifestyle. You care about the product and customer.
Yeah, I've got a very good sense for what our customers want and what is the right thing to do, but I'm not necessarily got the skills or the background to actually get it to happen.
Sure.
So I know what it looks like. I know what it should be, how it should behave. I know what should happen. So then I give my opinion and then other guys make it happen.
Very fair. It's been a bit of a rollercoaster journey, I guess, in between leaving a job and being the founder of a £220 million valued business. What are some of the worst moments?
I think every day is pretty bad sometimes, but that's the thing that I like about it. And this is what I was trying to say to somebody the other day. If you don't enjoy problems or grind, you're not going to be a good entrepreneur or founder. I think that, you know, every day, but they're the days you look back and they're sometimes the best days. So when you really, you know, when I was starting up Huel, you know, that when that company let me down, that was one of the really bad days. I just thought this is done at this point and just thought, you know, how am I going to get past this? You know, I've put a year into this and I haven't got anywhere. You know, you feel pretty soul destroyed at the time. But the following day, you get out of bed and start all over again. And that's sort of part of it. You know, I've seen one of these silly little graph meme things about, you know, one day you feel like a winner, the following day you feel like a failure, winner, failure, that type of thing. And it is that type of sense. And, you know, even now we're well established, you still think every day it could go to zero. You know, we've been let down by a company recently. You know, we've had some other technical problems in the background. You know, every day, and the problems are bigger now. So even though we're well established and you think that things are smoother, the problems just multiply and get bigger. So the worst days, yeah, quite often that happen. Not every day feels like the worst day, but they're all pretty tough sometimes.
Has there been a moment where you felt like you were going to give up on this journey?
Yeah, loads.
What do you do in that moment? I mean, are you the type to just sit around and mope and think about it? Do you go looking for support?
No, I don't look for support. I typically just think, fuck this, I'll do it. There's times when you just think, how are you going to get past this? But you just have to keep going. I think there's people who've done a lot harder things. So you think, well, if they can do it, why can't I do it? It can't be that difficult. And sometimes you think of just making a meal of it. So why don't you just crack on with it and get it done?
Making a meal of it is obviously the Huel way.
And what else are you going to do instead? You're going to go and work for somebody else? So you just think, I've got to get it done. And there must be a way to do this. You know, this is one of the sort of things, you know, you've got to go. There's no point in going the direct route. Sometimes you have to go around it or go under it or go over it. You know, have to find a more innovative way to get it done and, you know, just bulldoze your way through sometimes. And I think, yeah.
Professionally speaking, what has been the hardest day you've had at Huel?
I remember back at one Christmas Eve, I was doing, in the first sort of 6 months to a year, I was doing a lot of the evenings, you know, because I had, you know, small team in the daytime that was doing sort of customer service and doing Facebook answers and forum stuff. But in the evening, I didn't expect them to work. We didn't have any cover, so I did them all. I can remember one day, there was all these people on our own forum criticising us for doing something. I just thought, you guys are just being so, you know, we're trying to do the right thing. There's lots of other companies out there you can criticise. You shouldn't really be able to criticise us. We are generally trying to do the right thing. And so when they criticise you, it's quite hard to think, you know, fuck you, what are you, you know. So those days when people, the internet is full of sort of trolls and people are not the nicest people. So it can be sort of soul destroying. So those sorts of days, that is the day when you think, what am I doing this for? Why should I do this if I'm going to get a load of criticism? But you just have to push through.
Okay. What do you think going to do after Huel?
Somebody asked me this the other day. I've got no idea.
Listen, fuck that guy. We're asking it fresh. I know you don't tell him, but you've got to tell us. There must be some things you look around in the world and be like, that is mind-blowing, but I would do it slightly differently, and this is maybe how.
No, honestly, at the moment, I'm just 100% in Huel. So I just head down. He's like, you know, you said I've been doing a lot of podcasts lately. Yeah, but I suppose I've done 5 or 6 in total. And, you know, typically I don't come to networking events. I don't go to speaking events. I try to keep it to the bare minimum. The reason I like podcasts is that, I said earlier, they're scalable. So, you know, I can do one, I can give loads of answers, hopefully, in one of these sort of podcasts. And then anybody I get, you know, emailed or LinkedIn all the time asking me to give advice, can you spend 20 minutes for coffee? Can you give me 15 minutes on the phone? No, not really. Go listen to this podcast. I give a lot of information in that. So I like doing these, but typically I'm just, or somebody asked me to speak at conference the other day about new foods. Because I've got no idea about anybody else's. I don't know what anybody else is doing in the industry. I'm just doing my own thing.
Okay. How about this? A perfect way to end. What are some of the most common questions you get asked on LinkedIn? And answer them here on the podcast.
Okay. So typically people will say, how did you pick your category? And I suppose, you know, how did you pick the product you wanted to launch? Okay,
Julian, how did you pick the product you wanted to launch?
Well, it was a product that I realized I and my friends needed. So that's how I did it. They said, how do you create a great brand? So I think a great brand, I think you have to start with a good name, good logo. So the visual identity is one part of the brand. But for me, it's every single thing that the customer experiences. So it's the delivery box, it's the pouch, it's the way the pouch opens, it's the email they receive, it's the fact that we put a thank you card in, it's our customer service when they answer, it's the right type of people. So we, you know, it's every single little thing. It's the attention to detail that makes a great brand, I think.
What advice have you been given on your journey that has been life-changing for you?
This is going to sound a little bit weird, but this was pre-entrepreneurial journey. This was outside. This was actually a long, long time ago. When I was at university, I did work on a building site, and I was struggling. We were putting houses together, like timber frame houses, and it was getting late in the day, and there was this big timber frame panel came in, and it wouldn't fit. So, you know, you're like, right, where are we going to get? We've got to get this done. And then one of the guys come over, he goes, and I was like struggling for ages to get this done. I couldn't get it fitted. And in the end, he said, look, if it don't fit, just force it. So he just came over with a massive sledgehammer, just whacked it, put it in place, off we go, gone on. So ever since then, I've always remembered that. And I think when you get to a certain problem, you sort of sometimes can think, what's the logical way to get around here? How do you do it? Sometimes you just brute force. You just got to push straight through. And that's quite often get things done, sometimes very simply, just by sort of like, I don't know, calling for a new frame to be fitted or cutting it down or making a new order. Just hit it with a sledgehammer and get it in.
And surprisingly, we usually get a different answer by asking this. It sounds like it might be the same. But what advice would you give to entrepreneurs starting up? And I guess especially ones in the food and drink category.
There's lots of advice. I've written a little bit on my Instagram the other day. There was somebody asked me, how do you become a millionaire? And so sort of the same sort of advice would follow. The first thing you do, you've got to bloody start. A lot of people don't start. If you don't start, you're never going to get there. Having some sort of, it depends on what your objective is though. So have some sort of clear objective for what you're trying to do. So my first business was make money. Huel was to be proud of doing something. So slightly different ways you'd approach stuff. I think for Huel, being mission-based is very good because it gives you that sort of North Star you're going after and you know what you're doing. And I think having that big mission, which is on nearly every wall in our office, helps recruitment, helps attract customers as well, and gives you that sort of, you can't deviate and go into new areas. And but I think sometimes you're just going at it harder than you think you need to. So put more effort in. You need to become obsessed in the first 18 months, 2 years. You need to be 100% in. You know, you say no to all events, you say no to going to agencies, come and see me, you know, you know, try and get totally into it. Then you will see every single problem, be your own customer, your own user, you know, use the product day in, day out, and then you'll experience what the problems are with it. You know what needs to be fixed. Direct to consumer, I think, was really beneficial for us. So you get close to your customers as best as you can. So people say, you know, go out the building and meet your customers. We didn't need to. It was online. They're always coming to us. So I did customer service for a long time. I did all the Facebook answers in the evening for probably 18 months. Forum, you know, you just get really close to your customers. I think they're super, super powerful because you can see the problems and you can iterate a lot faster. You see that problem, fix it. Another problem, fix it.
Instead of like a short, snappy answer, we literally got a Bible of how to build a brilliant brand. So thank you very much for that. Julian, it's been a pleasure to get you on Secret Leaders. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me.
How do some of the world's sharpest minds start their day? By putting their brain first. And it's not just our Secret Leaders who kick off every day with heights. From Stephen Fry to best-selling author and fellow podcaster Dr. Rangan Chatterjee, who give us rave reviews. So if you care about your brain's health and cognitive potential, think heights. Listeners can get 25% off their first month with the code LEADERSHEIGHTS at www.yourheights.com.
Next week on Secret Leaders.
The ultimate vision is to be able to sate your curiosity about anything in the physical world at the moment at which you're looking at it.
The secret of our success was that we knew nothing about music. Whenever we heard songs, we'd be like, what is that? And that's how we came up with the idea for Shazam. I blame my business partner. He would hear the most popular songs and go, I have no clue. I'd love to find out. What if I could use my mobile phone to identify music?
That was Jess Butcher from Blipper and Dheeraj Mukherjee of Shazam, the founders of two of the most visionary companies ever produced in the UK, one that went well and one that sadly didn't. This was actually our first ever live recording of Secret Leaders. And at the time, Blipper, a pioneer in augmented reality, was still going and valued at over $1 billion. And Shazam was in the running to be sold to Apple. It's a really pertinent and valuable reminder to all entrepreneurs that no matter your perceived success at the time, the journey is long and full of surprises. At the time, Jess had left Blipper already, so the fate of the company was out of her hands. She's since started a new brilliant company, reimagining social media, called Tick, which you can check out at tick.done. Dheeraj exited Shazam to the world's biggest company, Apple, for £400 million, and now spends a lot of his time advising and investing in startups. And next week's episode focuses on how you can come up with such visionary concepts and take them to market for growth. It's innovation at its finest, only on Secret Leaders. So tune in or you'll miss out. We hope you enjoyed this episode. It was brought to you by me, Dan Murray-Serta, producer Rich Martell, editor Harry Morton of Lower Street Media, and marketing by Hannah Russell of Mags Creative, and stunning visual design by our talented designer Christina Naru of smartupvisuals.com. You can check out show notes, transcripts, and our upcoming live events on our website, secretleaders.com. If you've not yet, please hit subscribe. Leave us a review, tell a friend, take a screenshot of this episode and add it to an Insta story. I mean, you know what to do. And tag us at Secret Leaders or at Dan Murray Serta, and we'll add you to our story in appreciation back. Rich and I put together Secret Leaders for free because we love our day jobs as entrepreneurs, but every time someone takes the time to share it, it means a lot to us. So don't forget, it's the little things like that that keep us coming back every week and every year into the studio. See you next week.